Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Lunch call. Cardboard bed, sticky it's the rent for my daily lunch call. Cardboard beds and tickets are in for my daily lunch call.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Jamie Lou? Do y'all like Jamie Lou? Jamie Lou is an indie folk singer-songwriter originally from the Emerald Coast, but now resides in Arkansas. In 2012, she was the songwriting competition winner of the Yonder Mountain Harvest Music Festival, and in 2013, she was the co-grand prize winner of the Great Arkansas Talent Search. More can be heard at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Little Rock native Mark Simpson was, among other things, a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock multimedia artist Carla McGoldrick, with this piece right here behind me entitled Whisper, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Carla at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our writers all grapple with communication and the messages they are sending. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Guy Choate is caught between a rock and a hard place with his message. And we'll end the night with Alan Reese as the more he talks, the deeper he gets. But let's start the night with Jan Van Sciver and her message that has the opposite effect than intended in Trouble on My Bumper.
It was 1992, and I had just moved back to the Ozarks after living 20-plus years in California. On a crisp autumn day, looking to buy some birdseed, I drove past the Northwest Arkansas Mall and pulled into the parking lot at Lowe's. As I got out of my Toyota, a Dodge Ram loomed into the space behind me. A man in a cowboy hat, pearl-button shirt, and sharp-toed boots emerged from the truck and approached. "Is this your car?" From his tone, I wondered if I'd cut him off in traffic. I didn't remember doing so. "Yes," I said. Seemed no point in denying the obvious.
"What do you mean, having that bumper sticker?"
His face was pink. His hands seemed ready for something, although they were still. I followed his gaze to my car, where a lone bumper sticker read, "Visualize World Peace." I looked back to him. "Well," I said, "it's my gift to other drivers. World peace is something I want to encourage." I noticed the crisp creases in his jeans. His wife must put a lot of starch in those before she irons them, I thought. Then his ice blue eyes caught mine. The man's jaw clenched as he tried to stare me down.
"What makes you think mankind has anything to do with world peace? Only Jesus Christ can bring peace to this planet."
My chest started to feel as tight and uncomfortable as his jaw looked. I said, Don't you think we have something to do with it, too? After all, people are the ones who start wars. His voice rose.
We have no power. Only Jesus can save us.
He sounded like a preacher, expecting answering shouts of amen and hallelujah. I hoped my attacker didn't realize how fast my heart was beating. I held my voice steady as I said, of course we need Jesus' help. We need all the help we can get to make peace happen. The man seemed to stretch taller as he waved his arms and thundered,
how can you have the audacity to think people can bring about peace? Mankind has no power. Mankind is a lowly worm. Call upon the Lord.
With every sentence, his voice grew louder and more strident. His hands formed fists and looked ready to pound a pulpit. Around us, people pushed carts out of the store, loaded their cars, and left. Others arrived and walked into the store as if nothing unusual was happening. Part of me was totally focused on the furious man in front of me. Part of me was outside my body, observing the larger scene and wondering, did the passersby notice this angry man? Why didn't they stop? Did they think he was justified in his actions as he enlightened the California hippie he was confronting? Now, it's true, I grew up in northeast Oklahoma, in the foothills of the Ozarks. But right after college, I did move to California. A good job waited there for me. But more than the work, I wanted adventure and to see something different than what I'd grown up with. I sure found it. People from all over the world, all races and religions and clothes and passions, all living mixed up together. Plus, towering redwood trees, the ocean, the high Sierras, scenery so spectacular, I felt I had to stand and cheer for every new vista. When I left home, I didn't expect to be gone over 20 years, but that's what happened. Finally, I tired of the crowds and the fast pace of West Coast life, and I wondered if I could come home. Home to the old, gentle mountains where I used to breathe easy. After spending so long away, I worried about moving back to the Ozarks, worried about moving to a place so culturally and politically different from California. But my beloved grandmother was sick, and I hated being so far away from her. I realized that would happen more as my mom and my aunts kept getting older. Plus, I needed a slower, less crowded life. I decided to take a chance and make the move. I was right about the unhurried pace. Even business people take their time here. In 20 years of shopping in California, not once had a salesperson said, "What can I do for you, honey?" and listened to my answer with genuine interest. And the first few times strangers waved at me from their pickup trucks, as I passed them on Washington County's gravel roads, I was puzzled. Why would they wave? Do they think they recognize me? Eventually, I realized they were just being friendly, and I started waving back, imitating the casual lift of a finger off the steering wheel. Mostly, the Southern politeness felt just fine, although the first time someone called me ma'am, my 45-year-old self wanted to protest. I'm not that old. My worries about the move soon faded, lulled by the comfortable, familiar landscape and by the friendliness radiating from folks as I drove, shopped, and threaded my way through the complexities of registering my car, a process involving personal visits to the tax assessor and the Department of Motor Vehicles, with offices located on opposite sides of town. This was the same Toyota that had spent the last 10 years with me on the West Coast. As I got tired of dealing with life in California, driving the freeways became especially difficult. When I found myself in gridlock, I would start to sweat and want to spring from my car, jump the freeway fence, and run for the hills. One thing that helped me calm down was seeing Visualize World Peace on the bumper of the car in front of me in stop-and-go traffic. Thinking of world peace always brought a balm, a moment apart from the cars changing lanes and braking suddenly and crowding in around me. So I sought out a sticker, peeled off the backing, and pressed it on my bumper like a prayer, a gift to the other drivers on the freeway. Now I was the one who needed a prayer, as the parking lot preacher loomed in front of me, intent on making me see the light. I shrugged my shoulders slightly and turned my palms up. Sir, I am not excluding the Lord. I think we're all in this together. I hoped my face was neutral, but I wasn't sure. On that bright day, in a public parking lot, I felt afraid. He raised his fist as if to strike me. The ligaments in his neck were like taut wires holding his head on his shoulders. I sucked in my breath. For a moment, nothing moved. His icy eyes bored into mine. I held his gaze until he spun on his heel and headed for the store, strutting like a rooster. After the automatic door slid shut behind his stiff back, I leaned against my car, trying to understand what had just happened. All this anger over a bumper sticker? A sticker with a slogan about peace? I wondered if I could safely enter the store, knowing he was inside. After a moment, I did. I bought a sack of seed and carried it out, grateful to find both my car and the peace sticker still intact. That was the first time in my life I felt gratitude to find my car okay in daylight in a public lot. Prior to that incident, I'd assumed both my car and I would be safe in such a place. Now I was no longer sure. Visualize world peace, I thought to myself. Breathe and imagine. I got into my car and drove away, thinking about the man in the parking lot, as several folks in pickup trucks waved at me on the way home.
Jan Van Sciver's bumper troubles continue. She recently left her car at the Tulsa airport and returned to find her Obama decal gone. Now she's wondering how long her Buffalo River Flows Free sticker will last. Next, let's go to a high school basketball game with Guy Choate as he struggles with which message to send in Don't Send Me In, Coach.
Today's the day, Choate, my friend Rory says to me. I'll do it if you do it, I tell him. I promise. We stand beside each other in full pads just as we do every day, sweating it out on the sidelines of the practice field, trying to talk each other into quitting the team. Neither of us can muster the courage because we aren't sure what will happen to us if we do. In our small Arkansas town, if you don't play football, you're nothing. I don't just mean it hurts your social status at school, I mean you lose respect from the community. All my dad's best high school stories directly relate to his time as a BB Badger football player. Each story tells of a tightly knit group of rebellious teenagers who represented our fine city against the bastard sons of neighboring towns like Lone Oak or Batesville or Ball Knob. But when the football season ends and school is coming to a close, I'm surprised with a choice. Go to the field house if I want to play football next year, or to the gym if I want to play basketball. Without thinking of the consequences, I walk to the gym as fast as I can go. I'm relieved to find my cousin Will has made the same decision. We pledge solidarity to each other, assuring ourselves our parents won't kill us for not playing football. I need to concentrate on my basketball game, Will says. Yeah, me too, I say. Will's good at basketball. I'm not, no matter how much I concentrate. Once, a teammate threw me an inbounds pass and I could see a clear path to the goal, which I took. I was the last person in the building to realize it wasn't my goal. There are other challenges. I can't dribble with my left hand, for instance. I can't dribble well with my right. I can't jump very high, I can't shoot very well, and when I find myself alone in the paint while the opponent is driving, I always manage to give up a foul and the basket. Such is the scene I'm hoping to avoid in the game against McCrory, where I sit on the bench. The third quarter comes to a close, our victory inevitable, and Coach Hill gives us, the bench warmers, the nod to enter the game. After a short obligatory pep talk, he releases us from our huddle to go one-on-one with our opponents. We know we are up against a squad of players who are also probably entering the game for the first time in weeks. I look toward our opponent's bench with great anticipation to see whom the Jaguar is to my Badger. Who is going to set up on the wing against me? All I want is equivalence. I'm quite willing to sacrifice my shot at stardom as long as the man I have to guard doesn't want to make a joke of me. I know what we do on the court doesn't matter to anyone but us as long as we don't embarrass ourselves. I have no illusions of maybe playing in the NBA one day. Basketball is just a prison sentence to me, a block of time that has to pass before I can be released from the confinement of team sport hell. Just let me do my time and be discharged honorably so I can salvage what respect I still have in the community after forsaking the religion of football. When I see the man I'm supposed to guard, I feel tremendous relief. He is shorter than me, smaller than me, and it's even obvious as he jogs over from his team's bench in his black and orange uniform, he is clumsier than me. In fact, he's developmentally disabled. There is no way anyone is going to pass the ball to him. And I'm prepared to live up to my end of the bargain by not trying to run all over him. How's it going, I say. He takes his position. I hold out my hand to give a gentlemanly low five, but he leaves me hanging and doesn't say a word. His eyes shifted when I spoke, so I know he heard me. Then he gives me a serious look, a really serious look, and I'll admit I am scared. This kid is going to try everything in his power to embarrass me, and he isn't pretending otherwise. It doesn't matter at first, though, because we just run up and down the court from end to end. Every time I can tell that a teammate is looking to pass me the ball, I pretend not to notice and throw up a scream so someone else can get open. I must look like the most unselfish player on the court in my attempt to not touch the rock, as they say. But for all my effort to avoid the ball on offense, my counterpart tries twice as hard to get it while he's on offense. I cover those passing lanes heavily. This is my best defense of the season, I'll have to admit. But with just minutes left in the game, a Jaguar point guard dribbles straight toward him, and there is nothing I can do to prevent my man from grabbing the handoff. The crowd begins cheering louder, which terrifies me. My opponent stands still with the ball long enough for me to experience vertigo and also recover from it. Then he takes about 9 steps to my left without dribbling. Hallelujah, he'll be called for traveling and I'll be out of this mess. But the referee never blows the whistle and the guy keeps running toward the goal. The rest of his team has cleared out of the paint, pitting him against me, mano a mano. I think about how many times my opponent has driven on me in the past and how I've always fouled him as he made an easy layup. Coach Hill has tried to teach me to stand my ground instead of getting out of the way. Now I am again looking down the barrel of likely humiliation. My opponent tucks the ball, ducks his head, and charges the goal, only making a minimal effort to run around me rather than through me. I backpedal, easily staying ahead of his clumsy legs, while also giving him plenty of room should he decide to, I don't know, dribble. I am not going to foul him. All I want to do is stay in front of him, keep him from the basket. I can see my coach in my head telling me to hold my ground. But this seems so different. The guy gives head fakes even I don't fall for. I'm in a tough spot. I've been trained to guard the basket, but at no point in practicing every day after school have we addressed the ethics of how to guard a kid with developmental disabilities. A lose-lose situation. If I keep the kid from taking the shot, I'm insensitive to the core, and everyone in the gym will know it. But if I let him take the shot, and he makes it, I'll never live down being the bench warmer who got schooled on the court by the disabled kid. My athletic abilities are already in question, and to be frank, I'm trying to run the figurative bases with my new cheerleader girlfriend. She stands holding her pom-poms at the end of the court watching me. I can't afford embarrassment. I'm still not sure what my plan is, even as my awkwardly unstable opponent pulls the ball with both hands from his chest and thrusts it toward the goal with everything he has. I try not to think about how this will hurt my reputation. I try to think instead about how my girlfriend will think I'm the sweetest guy in the world for letting the kid score. how everyone else on the cheerleading squad will wish they could find a boyfriend as sensitive as me. Nobody's going to tease me in the halls of my high school for giving up a layup to this kid who is at least a foot and a half shorter than me. Will they? Yes, they will. I know that for sure. So I pack him. I record my only career block. It's a real jerk move. Both referees immediately blow their respective whistles, calling a foul on me. Even though I know I got all ball. The bleachers erupt with anger. Even my teammates boo me. The nearest referee shoots me a look as if I've just propositioned his daughter. I notice my dad in the bleachers dropping his head into his hands in disappointment. Coach Hill is miffed. He angrily instructs me to go back to the bench, at which point I decide it's about time I start concentrating on my tennis game. Thank you very much.
Guy Choate only graduated from college at UALR because he found a way to get around taking college algebra. And now he somehow has a master's degree in creative nonfiction writing from the University of New Orleans, my alma mater. He maintains a photo-a-day blog at getoutofthisplace.tumblr.com. In our final story of the night, Alan Reese sends mixed messages and finds himself in too deep in Kilimanjaro.
In an age when many men discover that they have a favorite chair, I began to climb mountains. I did have one of those chairs. It was pretty typical, I think. It reclined, was beer-stained and worn, a little bit brown, and had Cheetos, coins, and other treasures under the cushion. And I really was thinking that the rest of my life could be spent in that chair. But my friend Don changed everything. He called one day and asked, "Hey, do you know what a 14er is?" I didn't, so he told me. It's a mountain over 14,000 feet high, and Colorado has more than 50 of them. I just climbed one. Let's go climb another one. So we did. He led me up my first 14er, and over the next few years, we did close to a dozen more. Each was exhausting and exhilarating. Then one day, I was reclined in the chair, looking down at myself, wondering how I could possibly have dropped so much salsa onto my shirt from a single chip, when Don called again. "Hey, have you heard of Kilimanjaro?" "Of course. It's in Africa. It's very tall, and for some reason it makes me think of Stuart Granger movies and safaris." "Right. It's over 19,000 feet high. Let's go climb it." So we talked. We discussed the costs, the difficulties, the timing, and all the things we thought we would encounter on a trip to Africa. I talked it over with my wife, and we decided to do it. But I had a condition. To pay for it, I was going to get a part-time job, and until I had stashed away enough to go, we wouldn't go. Luckily, almost immediately, I found a job that was interesting. On my first day, I told Craig, my distressingly young supervisor, why I was working. Kilimanjaro. He was very, very impressed. Remember that. Time passed. Months went by. I got involved in the project I was working on. We climbed more 14ers, and like many things in life, Kilimanjaro gently slipped into the background. I found myself looking at that brown chair again, and eventually I decided to quit the part-time job. I gave my notice, my young supervisor expressed his regrets, and began looking for a replacement. The afternoon of my last day, Craig came to get me. He led me to a very full break room where people filled all of the chairs, and more were standing around leaning against walls. Even full-time employees were there. This was nothing normal, and I wondered what was going on. Craig took me to a table facing the room and sat me down. Then he began to speak. "As you all know, this is Alan's last day with us. I've invited everyone here to wish him well and to ask him if he would speak to us a bit about his plans to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa." I had never mentioned to him that our plans had withered away, and all this time he had remembered them. It became horribly silent. Every face, every eye turned to me. All the moving parts in my body froze. All the non-moving parts began a silent shriek. More than 50 people stared at me. Me, the adventurer, the man who would bring mysterious, cloud-covered, exotic Mount Kilimanjaro to its knees. Every woman's face bordered on adoration. Every man's face had a slightly dismissive look that said, "Yeah, I could do it if I wanted to." I was literally stunned, and I didn't know what to do. On the one hand, to reveal that it wasn't going to happen would be a crushing disclosure. I would look foolish, and Craig would look foolish. On the other hand, if I told everyone that I was actually going to... Now, let me step aside for a moment. You all remember what your mother told you about lying. You remember, don't you? It's bad. It's a sin. It leads to no good. All of our lives we've known, if you lie, you are going to hell. So I began to lie. In an unbelievably fortunate stroke of luck, I had watched a documentary about Kilimanjaro not two nights before. I knew of its multiple summits, its flora and fauna, its climate zones, its melting glaciers. I knew about the Kibo Hut at 15,000 feet and the Coca-Cola Trail. A wide-eyed data entry operator broke the silence. You're really going to climb Kilimanjaro? With a near paralyzed tongue, I get out a very tentative and hoarse, yeah. Another question, and another. I knew the answers, all of them. No, no, don't you worry, we won't be dealing with lions. Well, now, your mountain gorilla is extremely shy, so chances are... Yes, we'll summit without oxygen. I began to relax. I slouched comfortably. My voice became smooth and dramatic, my smile patient. I waved an arm airily at the silly questions and leaned forward on my elbows, looking serious over the serious ones. I became Ernest Hemingway, Stuart Granger, and Dr. Livingston all in one. Then it was over. I shook many hands, accepted many good lucks, and walked to my car. I got in, and a voice went screaming through my head, "What the hell did you just do?" Even sitting there alone, I was filled with embarrassment and disbelief at what I had just done. I called my wife and told her what had happened. "You did what? Why did you do that?" I didn't know. I called Don, who had started all this in the first place. I finally had to hang up on him because he started laughing and I couldn't shut him up. Even today, years later, Kilimanjaro causes great amusement amongst my friends and family, and I'm still ashamed of myself for deceiving all of those people. But it wasn't over. Remember the other thing about lies? Remember? They never go away. I went back to my brown chair with its Cheetos and coins and to my salsa-stained T-shirts. Time passed, 6 months, maybe seven. On a Saturday night, a few couples, including my so-called friend Don, decided to attend a women's volleyball match at the college. Very good team, popular and well-attended games, small venue. We were seated high in the bleachers facing the entry. The teams were warming up and we were all chatting when I glanced at the doors and saw Molly walk in. Molly, friendly, dark-eyed, lovable Molly, who had sat entranced and enchanted in the break room during my Kilimanjaro performance. She strolled in with the crowd, and I knew what was going to happen. There were 2,000 seats in that arena, but I knew what was going to happen. I turned to my wife and gasped a very hoarse, "Oh, no." She got a worried look, put her hand on my arm, but I said nothing to turn to watch Molly. I watched her as she walked around the floor, around to our side, to the stairs leading to our section, to the row in which I sat, to the seat one person over to my left. She hadn't noticed me, but my eyes were frozen on her. It was like I could sense an impending disaster, and I couldn't look away. Behind me, my wife made a gurgly sound I recognized. It was her version of a smothered laugh. I looked back at my friends. They were all staring at me with raised eyebrows and looking very, very amused. "Alan!" There it was. I turned and squeaked out, "Oh, wow, Molly!" She leaned over the person between us and began to go on in her lovable, excited, dark-eyed way about how wonderful it was to see me, how people missed me at work, how she had been promoted. And then it came. How was Kilimanjaro? Everyone has been wondering. Was it difficult? Did you get pictures on top? We'd all love to see them. Can you come back and talk to us? Instantly, the truth leapt out of me. Molly, we didn't make it over there. Kilimanjaro didn't happen. I was surprised at the disappointment on her face, and I felt a pang of shame that I had created this myth. "Oh, no," she said. "I'm really sorry. What happened? Why didn't you go?" Now, let me step aside for a moment. The human mind is truly remarkable. In milliseconds, it can process scores of difficult subjects and feelings. In that instant, I was clearly aware of all the lies I had told about that damn mountain. I was aware of the lessons and repercussions I had learned and suffered. I was aware of my friends, including Dawn, struggling to control themselves behind me and intently listening. I was aware that now was the time to fix things. I put on the bravest face I could muster and answered, because Dawn died. Yeah, that's what came out. Don was choking with laughter behind me. He had died and ruined the whole trip. I've learned nothing and I'm going to hell.
Alan Reese is a retired transplant from the Great Plains who hates humidity but loves back roads, remote and unusual places, mountaintops, old bars, 60s music, Jack Reacher books, Google Earth, Xbox, and tennis. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District in North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Original called Oh Darling. Prepare. But when I see you again,
my fears. Had I deserved.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.